Ladies and gentlemen, good morning. Welcome back to Kabbalah and Coffee. I want to begin on a somber note. I'm dedicating this class to a very dear friend, Miriam Halevi Ferrero, who passed away last week in Israel, in the Holy Land. And I think those of you that have been around here for a few years, I think you might remember Mora Miriam. She was our art teacher here at the Hebrew school. She had two boys and a little girl. She used to come around Sunday morning, so you've definitely seen her. And truly too young to be gone. Beautiful spirit. And we'll talk more about her maybe a little bit later. But I wanted to, just up front, dedicate this class to her. She was actually just laid to rest a few minutes ago in Israel. The funeral just happened this morning. Okay. So let's jump into the topic of the day. Our topic is love, marriage, intimacy, men and women, and giving and receiving. So last week I began by discussing the lost art of intimacy. And part of the notion behind that is that we're very good at loving. We're very good at loving. We love all the time. We love many different things. And because we love so many different things, we really love nothing. Right? We love people, but we also love, I'll just go back to my examples that I used last week, we also love chocolate, right? So I love my spouse, but I also love chocolate, and I love my car, right? And I love, what else do I love?
Roller skating,
and I love
your
sushi, and I love, well, my family, so that, but that's how I started. The point is that love becomes diluted the more things I love, and the more things I love using the same indiscriminate terminology, the more love ceases to mean any one specific thing. And the challenge is that we cease recognizing for ourselves what it really means to love. So if love, in its ideal state, is about a very tight closeness between the two parties, then perhaps a better word for that is intimacy, only because it hasn't been claimed by Facebook. As I said last week, Facebook started with likes. Fine. They didn't encroach on anything really deep. It was, I like something, I like this, I like that. Okay, you can like many things. But then they added, if you hover over the like button, so if more things pop up, right? And now you can actually love something. So now I don't actually have to be close to what I'm loving. I can be arm's distance across the world, and I can very easily, with a click of a button, say, I love this. Let me move on with my life. I love it, and I'm done. It's love and done. I love, and I'm out of here. See you later. So, that's the problem, right? The problem is, so what is love? Is that love? You just click a button, that's it. I've indicated my love, let's move on. I mean, is that really love? So, that's why the language that I'd like to use in our discussions, the language is intimacy. Intimacy implies a closeness between two parties, right? Intimacy implies a very intimate connection between two parties. And again, it's a word that hasn't been claimed by pop culture and by society. Right? So we haven't yet burnt out that word. And I don't intend on burning it out in this class either. My point is to use that word to kind of put it on a pedestal and say that is what we're attaining. That's what we're striving for. A sense of true closeness with somebody else. A sense of real intimacy. And there's two elements. There are acts of intimacy, right? Intimate acts, etc. But that's not what we're talking about. It's not about the manifestations. How do you create intimacy? It's not how do you act on intimacy once you have that closeness, right? That we don't need a class on. The question is, how do you develop an intimacy with somebody else? With somebody that is different than you. Somebody that is, by their own very definition, by the very physical parameters of existence, separate from you. So, you have two parties that are separate and distinct by their very natures. How do you create this type of closeness and intimacy that we'd all like to achieve? Whether it's with our spouses, first and foremost, whether it's with our other family members, our children, our parents, etc. How do we create this sense of intimacy with those whom we, we'll go back to the word, for those whom we love? So that was point number one from last week. That was the question that we raised at the beginning. The other question we raised last week, definitions and distinctions between men and women. And it's a very touchy subject today because the whole concept of gender is somewhat, at this point, has somewhat turned into a fluid conversation or a fluid topic. But we're going to discuss, and we're going to jump into this very, very soon, we're going to jump into what are the Jewish definitions, what are the Kabbalistic, what are the mystical definitions of gender? What is masculinity? What is femininity? What is male? What is female? According to Kabbalah and Hasidic philosophy. That's the second point. The third point is what does it mean to give and what does it mean to receive? The Hebrew words are mashpia and mekabel. Mashpia is giving, is the giver. The one who gives is the mashpia. And the one who receives is the mekabel, is the recipient. Like Kabbalah. Kabbalah means received wisdom. Kabbalah, that which is received. So the mekabel is the one who is receiving the whatever that is. So one is giving and one is receiving. And as I explained last week, in every relationship, indeed in every conversation, in any exchange, human exchange, you always have someone that's giving and someone that is receiving. In fact, think about the last time you went to a store. Let's say you went to a supermarket. Say you went to the Publix on Ponce, right across the street. So you go there, you take something off the shelf, and you go to the checkout area, and you put your item, it's not your item yet, you put the item on the old conveyor belt, right? Right. And the person takes it, the cashier, they take it, they scan it, they put it in a bag. Fantastic. Still not yours, right? What do? You then pull out, what do? Pull out a credit card. Maybe someone still pulls out cash. It always feels cool when I have cash and I pull out. I'm like, I'm paying with cash here. And it was like, whoa! They stop the store. They bring out the balloons and the confetti, and they're like, wow! The first customer of the month to pay with cash. You pay with cash? It's awesome, right? It's cool. Then the cashier has to make change. It's a whole situation. It's like, who needs change? Yeah, but it's That's what I mean. You now put that person on the spot by handing them cash. You're like, uh-oh, now what do I do? No, but they have the thing. I've been at stores, by the way. I don't remember where. I'm sure somebody can help me out. It's one of the big stores where when you give them cash, there's a chute for the change that automatically comes out. Mm-hmm. The cashier doesn't have to produce the change. It comes, the coins automatically come out, and they hand you the bills.
But if you try and give them, okay, so I'm going to give you 5 cents.
So you get a whole, yeah, I've done that also. Right. I want to give you the amount that I get back a quarter instead of 17 cents, and at that point, the whole system is, it's right. It's like, listen, you owe me $1,000. Like, why? It doesn't matter, because I use cash. Exactly. Right. Anyway, good. So you go to the store. So understand this. There is mashpia and mekabel. There's giving and receiving in that process. Let's discuss it. So you're giving the money and they're receiving the money. So you're the mashpia And they're the mekabel. You're giving and they're receiving. At the same time, they're giving and you're receiving. What are they giving? What are they get in a store? What are they giving?
You're supposed to give service.
Well, but practically, pragmatically, what are they giving?
The items.
The merch. Right? They're giving you the stuff. They're giving you the merchandise. They're giving you the food. They're giving you the clothing. They're giving you whatever it is, right? I was going to say the shelter, but you don't usually buy a home at the checkout thing. They're giving you the stuff, the item, so that they're giving you. So they give you, take, you receive, and then you give the money, and they receive the money. So my point is, in every interaction, it's not only in relationships, and it's not only in conversation and communication where there's someone speaking and someone listening, and then the other person speaks and the first party listens. It's not only that, but it's in almost every area in life, there's always a give and a take. It's always give and take and back and forth. Just that's the nature of life itself is mashpia and mekabel. As we're going to discuss today, the very fabric of the universe is predicated, is created by the very fabric of the universe is created by a give and a take of a cosmic union, which is the theme of today's class. So those were our introductions. Then we jumped into the concept of a wedding. This text that we're studying, this mystical text, the context of this text is a wedding. It was authored and recited in honor of the Rebbe's wedding in 1928 in Poland. And the discourse was recited specifically at the moment of the wedding that is known as the Kabbalah's Panim, which is where the guests welcome the groom, and then groom and guests together welcome the bride. This is before the chuppah. They welcome the bride, they put the husband-to-be, the chassan, the chatan, puts the veil over the bride's face, and then groom walks to the chuppah, bride walks to the chuppah, but it's at that moment of the Kabbalah's Panim, it was at that pre-Kabbalah's Panim moment that this discourse was first recited publicly. And it's about that experience and the mystical dimension of what is happening at a wedding at that juncture. But it's not only about that wedding or that specific moment, it really touches on the core of relationships, the core of gender, the core of what it means to give and to receive. So last week, we explained that, and we began with a verse that pertains to Shabbat, the Licha Dodi prayer, world-renowned Jewish prayer, sung in virtually every synagogue around the world on Friday nights. Lecha dodi lekrat kala penei Shabbat nekabla, which is translated here as "Come, my beloved, to meet the bride. Let us welcome the Shabbat." So let's, before we get too deep into this, let's make sure everyone has a copy. Please pass, take and pass, and take and pass, please. The prayer lecha dodi is a mystical prayer. It's a Kabbalistic prayer, authored by the Kabbalists, and yet it's made it mainstream. It went mainstream, and it's made it into, as I just mentioned, virtually every synagogue. I don't know of a synagogue that does not. I don't know every synagogue certainly, and what the services look like. So that's my caveat and my disclaimer. But every synagogue that I've heard about and that I have, people have told me what they do. So Friday night, this seems to be a staple, singing the Lecha Dodi. And it's a mystical prayer. Every stanza has another element of Kabbalah in it because it was authored by a Kabbalist, Rabbi Shlomo Halevi Alkabetz, in Tzfat, in Safed. So this is a super mystical prayer. And it refers to Shabbat as two things. We say, "Come, my beloved." It's an introduction. We welcome God. We call God my beloved. So this denotes also a certain sense of intimacy. If you're calling God my beloved, basically like my lover, if you're calling God my lover, that connotes intimacy right off the bat. You don't say, "God, can I have permission to welcome your Shabbat?" as like a reverential type of communication, like a subject to a master. That's not what we say. We're not asking permission like a subject to a master. We're not even relating to God as a child to a parent. which both of these types of relationships are, I would say, two of the more common ways of understanding our connection with God. In fact, on the High Holidays, there's a famous prayer, which the refrain is, Avinu Malkeinu, Avinu Malkeinu. Avinu Malkeinu means our Father, our King. We refer to God as Father and as King. And King is, of course, more distant, right? King is, again, subject, master, right? Servant, King, which there's a certain distance and awe and fear maybe perhaps involved there. Parent to child, Avinu, my Father, right? So that is, it's closer, and that's more love. That's still not as close as, come, my beloved, let's greet Shabbat. That's super close. If you say to God, come, come with me. You're not even asking permission. You're not saying, can I come with you? You're saying, I'm going, come with me. That's super, super intimate, if you will. Right? So you're saying, come, my beloved. You're calling God, my beloved. Lecha dodi, my beloved. And it's referring to Shabbat as bride and queen. Come, let's meet the bride. Let us welcome Shabbat. I'm sorry. In this stanza, we only refer to Shabbat as the bride. There are other stanzas that refer to Shabbat as the queen, which the discourse then proceeds to explain. So in the Lecha Dodi, we say Likrat Kala, to welcome. Come, let us welcome the bride. First thing we find off the bat is that Shabbat is a feminine energy. Shabbat is not called the groom. Shabbat is called the bride. Shabbat is also called Shabbat Malkata. Shabbat is also called the queen. Not the king, it's called the queen. So there's a feminine energy associated with Shabbat. And again, if we're doing word associations, which we are, we have three words that are virtually synonymous for the purpose of our conversation. Shabbat, queen, and bride. All three are the same energy. On an energy level, it's all the same. It's feminine, but it also denotes royalty and something very special. Shabbat, feminine energy, and I'm going to explain all of this as the class unfolds. Shabbat, feminine energy and lofty. Bride, feminine energy and lofty. Queen, feminine energy and lofty. So all three are synonymous, and the words are really virtually interchangeable. Yeah. Nikabla, let us welcome. So Pinei Shabbat, the verb is at the end in the Hebrew. Let us welcome. The Shabbat is the Nikabla, the welcome. The verb welcome is at the end in the Hebrews. Exactly. Right. We're going to get there in a second. Exactly. So if you notice in the language, excellent, in the language of the Lecha Dodi, we talk about receiving, listen to this, receiving the queen, receiving the bride, receiving Shabbat, which is going to be incredibly significant. Probably at the end of today's lesson, you'll see why that is very significant. First thing that we need to understand is, and this is where we jump into the new text today, and you should at this point all have either a book or a copy, and we're going to pick it up inside in a moment on 22, first page right there, 22, where it says Supernal Queen. But before we jump into the text, I need to give the following introduction, and that is that just as male and female, on this physical plane, the union of male and female produces new realities. So too it is on a cosmic level. And it's not because it works here that it works there. It's because it works there that it works here. So let me rewind that. On a biological level, if you want to produce a new person, let's make people, right? Let's make new people. You need the contribution from the male, and you need a contribution from the female. It's a union of male and female. It's that union, whether it happens in person or whether it happens in a lab, it doesn't actually matter. The point is you need the biological contribution of male and female to produce new life. That's the way it is. Each one on its own is insufficient to produce offspring. to really create, if you will, something from nothing, which is the closest that human beings can touch the divine. By the way, it says that having children is the closest thing to emulating God's creation of something from nothing. Because if you think about it, I mean, it's obviously not from nothing, but it might as well be. It's like, it's much easier to understand how you take paint and you spread it on the canvas and you've created art, it makes sense. Or you've taken a piece of clay and you've molded it, you've formed it to create something new. Or you've taken a piece of wood and you've cut it and nailed it and screwed it and glued it to create a table. That makes more sense. But reproduction, childbirth, I mean, that's, it's a bit mind-boggling. Nonetheless, the way it works, lamata, the way it works below on a physical plane of existence is that you need the contribution. And I know it's not true in all biological life. I'm sure. I'm not an expert in biology, in animal biology, in plant biology, in sea biology, in fowl biology, bird biology. I'm not the expert. So you got the wrong class if you were looking for a class on that, huh? I try to be. So I'm not an expert. Well, I see. I'm trying to be funny. I'm not trying to be an expert. So that's where the distinction lies.
That's clear.
The point, right? That's, clarity is king. So or queen. So the point is like this: that there may be some forms of life that don't require both types of genders. I don't know that. I think I've heard that at some point. Whatever. It is what it is. My point is that at least with human beings, you need the male and you need the female in some form or another. You need both contributions to make it happen, to create new life. That's the way, that's just simply the way it is. Okay. So the reason why this is so, physically, nothing happens by accident. Like I always say, this is the basic rule. Like if you want to know Kabbalah 101, the basic rule of Kabbalah is what I call spiritual gravity. And that is whatever is here fell from up there, right? If something is here, it had to fall from somewhere up there. There has to be a source. Nothing just starts here. It can't just start here. Everything has an origin in the spiritual realms. So if it's true that at least with human beings and other forms of life, that you need both masculine and feminine to create new life, so that's because, it's not because it works here, that it also exists above. Because it only works here because it works like that above. So the Kabbalists reveal to us how it works above. And the Kabbalists explain that it's only due to a union, which is the topic of today's class, it's only due to the union of masculine and feminine divine energies that anything exists. Because without that union of, so to speak, male and female, you can't have new life. So for existence to unfold, and the Kabbalists speak about this scaffolding of existence where you have different dimensions and different planes of existence. You have higher worlds and lower worlds, and in general there are four different dimensions of reality that parallel each other on progressively lower and more materialized dimensions until we hit our concrete universe. So in order to unfold, in order for this process to continue, and this evolutionary or devolutionary process to continue, it requires the union of zachar unekeva, of male and female, of course, not physical male and female in the spiritual realms, because there's nothing physical in the spiritual realms, but it's the spiritual energies of masculinity and femininity. It's that union of, using the language of the Kabbalists, dachar, which is like zachar in Aramaic, it's the masculine, and nukva, and the feminine, like nekeva, the nukva, it's the masculine and feminine union that produces the next dimension of reality. So if you're in one plane of existence, and it's still spiritual, so how does the next one unfold? You need to have a union to then give birth to the next dimension. That's how it works. There cannot. So here's the simple rule. After we have the gravitational rule, which is that everything here is sourced above, after that rule, here's the next rule. For something to be produced, there has to be a union. You can't have You can't create something, you can't produce something, you can't have offspring, spiritual or physical offspring, without first having a union. You ever think about that? Let's talk physically, right? Just in general. It's amazing that you cannot have something new, right? New life, unless there is a union between two fundamentally opposite forces. It's interesting, right? Right, masculine and feminine, the two, not only on an energy level, on a biological level, on everything, right? They are different and in some ways, in a sense, opposite. It's only through a co-joining, it's only through a union of opposites that something new can be produced. If anybody ever thought, let me pull out from this and speak now general terms. If anyone ever thought that you can create something innovative, from an echo chamber where everyone's agreeing with each other. So hopefully this will debunk that theory. You cannot produce something new and radically innovative, something achidish, or something really new and novel, unless there's a union of opposites. So if you're in a company, if you're in any situation, you want to produce something new, it's important to have a union, if you will, of opposite ideas to then produce something great. If you have an echo chamber, what I'm saying is simply this. It's significant, it's highly significant, that you cannot produce a child with just masculine, with just the male or just the female. With just masculine energy or just feminine energy. And I'm not speaking about specific parties, or it's not a very specific thing, it's more of a general thing that we can then apply. You have to have a union of opposites in order to produce something new. It's an amazing concept. And it comes from above. Because above, you have the same idea. You have the same, it's paralleled, that you have the same union of masculine and feminine energies that then produces the next dimension of spirituality. Is this making sense?
Vaguely.
Let me check in. Vaguely?
Absolutely. What are the opposites?
We'll get there in a second. So there's a refrain in prayer. Some have it more often in the prayer book. Some Jewish communities, some Jewish groups have a custom of saying this before many positive mitzvot. In Chabad, we say it once a day and that's it. Before the Baruch Shamar prayer and the Shachar prayers and the morning prayers. And the refrain is, L'shem Yichud. I'm doing this in order to create a unification. Yichud is a unification. L'shem yichud, kucher brichu shchinte. In order for this is the, I'm doing this. I'm about to do this mitzvah in order to create, to bring about the unification of kucher brichu, which is kucher brichu means like the Holy One, blessed be He, and shchinte and His shchina. What is the shchina? The divine presence. Now, the Kabbalists explain that what is kucher brichu and shchinte. So it's the masculine energy of the divine, is the divine masculine energy, and the divine feminine energy. The Shechina, if you've ever heard of the word Shechina, which is generally referred to as, translated as, the divine presence, that's very vague and it doesn't really mean much. What is the divine presence? So it means the feminine energy of the divine. Just like human beings have. There's masculine and feminine within human beings. So too, God also projects, I'm going to say Himself, but that's obviously not correct, which as I'm about to say, God projects Himself in both masculine and with both masculine and feminine energies, or in that modality of both masculine and feminine. So the way it works specifically, if we want to drill it down, we're going to go back to our trusty Sphero chart, something that you've seen, if you've been here for a while or any measure of time, you've seen countless number of times, but today we're going to look at it from a different perspective than we have in the past. Today we look at it from a masculine-feminine duality dimension.
You said kudsha
brichu? Kudsha, it's like HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but in Aramaic it's kudsha, so I would spell it like K-U-D or Kuvav Dalet Shin Aleph, kudsha, and then brichu, yeah. We're going to get into that. We're going to get into that. Hey, good morning. Welcome, welcome.
So I'm not trying to be feminist,
Oh no, we're about to get into that. You trust me, you will be blown away about what we're going to say in a second. Hold on, it's on the next page, so it may not be a second. It's going to be a few seconds. Welcome. Good to see you again. To a certain extent. You'll see. The Kabbalists might disagree with that, is what I'm saying. But hold on. Now, so let's jump into masculine energies and feminine energies, the way they exist above. Okay, so God, the Jewish understanding and the mystical, the Kabbalistic understanding of God is that God is indescribable and beyond definition. Why do we say that? We say that because that's what we believe God is. God is beyond any specific definition, because definition implies limitation. In other words, once you've defined something, you've created parameters around what it is, and you've now distinguished what it is from what it's not, right? Anything that has a definition, I call this a cup. What that means is it's not a bird. Every definition is it's wonderful to have definition, but at the very same time as it defines it, it also limits it. In fact, another word for limitation is definition. You talk about the physical parameter of something, where it goes and where it stops, that is its literal, well, it's all its definition. That's how it's defined, i.e. that's how it's limited and constrained. So when it comes to God, the Jewish understanding and the Kabbalistic understanding is that God is not limited. God creates limitation, but limitation is born of a reality that is unlimited, that is not limited, not subject to those self-same limitations. Thus, God is undefined, unlimited, indescribable, in the language of the mystics, pashut betachlit hapshitut, which means God is, pashut is sometimes translated as simple, but it's not simple in a simplistic way. It's simple in the sense of undefined. Whereas that which is complex is composite, is defined, has certain parameters, has extension, etc. God is pashut. God is simply undefined, indescribable, betachlet hapshitut, with the epitome of non-description. In other words, God is totally beyond any description. At the same time, the Kabbalists tell us that God projected himself in 10 energies, within 10 sphirot. When God decided, and that's obviously putting human terminology upon God, but when God, we'll say it anyway because we have no other language to use. When God, at whatever point, beyond points in time, right? Whenever God, however that works, decided to create a physical reality or create a constrained reality that would ultimately end up in our physical reality, God, at that point in time, emanated these 10 divine energies to utilize in the creation and in the formation of these dimensions. These are the 10 sphirot, the 10 energies that Kabbalah speaks of at length. So, yeah. It doesn't define God. It defines God's. It defines God's expression, or it defines God's modality of creation. In other words, as God steps out of himself to create or to project, God assumes these 10. God doesn't assume the form. I don't mean that God morphs into this, but God utilizes these 10 energies through which to create. To give an example, and this is obviously a super, super, super flawed example, but think of an artist that is truly creative, that could create any number of creative works, but in front of him or her are 10 colors. There's a palette, right? You have a palette, and there's 10 colors. And at this point, the artist is going to create something on art on a canvas, utilizing, I'm thinking of Bob Ross, happy trees, right? Creating art with these 10 colors. So I'll ask you a question. Is the artist limited to these 10 colors? Not essentially. But in this moment of creation, in this modality, in this moment of projection and expression, this person is now constrained by choice to these 10 colors of, good morning, to these 10 colors of the, here, pass this down. To these 10 colors that are at their disposal. So what that means is that God, even as God creates, the essence of God remains beyond any definition. But in the context of creation, God God utilizes these ten forces to create. Could God have done it a different way? Absolutely. The Kabbalists do say, however, that had God not projected himself through these 10 forms of these 10 specific defined sefirot, the creation that would be produced would, like its source, be fundamentally unlimited. So it wouldn't have the parameters of limitation. So in order to have a limited reality, it had to be produced through using limited tools. Because otherwise, you're using unlimited tools, you can't create a
limit. Our senses, that's how we interpret the world.
Right.
That defines
our reality to a certain extent. Exactly. Exactly. Even though the soul is beyond that. The soul certainly can understand and perceive beyond that. But as it exists inside of us, it kind of is limited using our reality. Now, the difference is obviously that God, even as God exists within this whole schematic of creation, and in that modality, God exists simultaneously outside of that reality. And that reality doesn't define the essence of God. So really, we're talking about two dimensions, and even using dimensionality with God is a misnomer, but let's just use this terminology. God operates on two dimensions. The one dimension is the essential dimension, where God remains pure and unlimited, and one is the as God relates to creation, where God projects these 10 energies. Now, we're not going to talk about the top three that are colored in blue. Those are the intellectually framed divine energies, Chachma, Bina, and Dat. Let's focus on the bottom seven. These are known as the emotive energies, if you will, of the divine, emotive divine energies. We have Chesed, which is love, Gevura, which is severity or withholding. So Chesed is love or giving, Gevura is severity or withholding, Tiferet is compassion, Netzach, so the way you read it, by the way, is just right, left, center, center. Netzach is ambition, Hod is devotion, Yesod is bonding, and Malchut here is translated as leadership, but as we'll see today, we're going to give it a different translation, and the translation that I'd like to give is receptivity. Receptivity. So, Kabbalah explains that the first six energies in red, Chesed, Gevura, Tiferet, Netzach, Hod, Yesod, those six energies depicted here in two triangles, right, left, center, so that first triad, that first triangle, and then you have the second triangle. Those six energies are the masculine emotive energies. Those are all masculine in nature. Chesed, Gevura, Teferet, Netzach, Hod, and Yesod are all masculine energies. They're about giving. So now we're touching on a very fundamental definition, the way Kabbalah defines masculine energy versus feminine energy, and it ties into the giver and the receiver, giving and receiving, bestowing and receptivity. So, giving is associated with a masculine energy, receiving associated with a feminine energy. Now, that doesn't mean that men give, that all men are givers and all women are receivers. That's not what it means. What it means is that the masculine energy is the giving energy, and the feminine energy is the receiving energy. And in a conversation, for example, in a dialogue, so each party takes on both energies. So the one who's speaking is taking on a masculine role. The one who's listening is taking on a feminine role. And when the other party begins talking, they take on the masculine role, and the other one takes on the feminine role. But in general, one is associated, giving is associated with masculinity, and receiving with femininity. The reasons or the associations with this biologically can be very well understood. Again, if we're looking at this on a very basic biological level, and we also mentioned before that it's precisely the union of male and female that produces offspring, right? How do you create life, human life in this world? It's through the union of masculine and feminine, of male and female. So in that context, certainly the masculine, there's giving and receiving, again, biologically. And hence the association on an energy level between masculine being giving and feminine being receiving. Now, and again, when it comes to people, we each have masculine energy and feminine energy. Both men and women have both energies, and thus it's not gender specific necessarily. But let's get back to the way it exists on a cosmic level. The six energies, chesed through yesod, that are considered the masculine energies, so they are known in Kabbalah as Ze'er Anpin. Ze'er in Aramaic means small, and Anpin means face. So Ze'er Anpin means literally the small face. The small face is the six energies. That is the six energies from Chesed to Yesod. Also known by the acronym Ze'er Anpin, in Hebrew is Zion Aleph, the acronym of which is Zah. So Zah, Ze'er Anpin, the six energies, the six Sfirot, Chesed, Gevura, Teferet, Netzach, Hod, and Yesod, that comprises the masculine energies of the Sfirot. Yeah.
Why the small?
Small face. There's also Arach Anpin, which is the large face, and that exists above this entire schematic. That exists beyond these parameters of the Sfirot. Keter, which we've talked about many times in other classes, Keter, which is the crown, which is beyond the 10 Sfirot, Keter has two dimensions within it. Keter has Atik Yomin, which means ancient of ancient days. And it has Arach Anpin, which is the long face or the large face.
Is there with an ayin or an aleph?
Which one? Anpin?
Arach
is aleph. Aleph. So. Arach Anpin are both aleph. Aleph, aleph. Arach Anpin. Yes. And Atik Yomin is ayin. Atik Yomin, ayin yud. Yeah. So, but that's Keter. So there is a large face that's outside of what we're covering today. Now, I will tell you, also within that, there's masculine and feminine, but that's on a different level. That's on a much loftier level. I mean, this is also lofty, but this is... I'm framing it like this because this is how our discourse is.
Can you say the large face, if it includes Atik Amen and...
It's Atik Yomin and Arach Anpin.
Atik Yomin and Arach. Is that contained within the large face?
So Arach Anpin is called, that literally translates as the large face. So that's the lower dimension or the more external dimension of Keter. That's what that is. Within the schematic though, within the structure, and I love this depiction of the Sfirot because it has the lines between it. It almost looks like a construction site, you know, where you see kind of how you build out, like scaffolding, right? You're building out a framework. So this is how the framework is built out. At the substance of this framework, you have six masculine points of energy. The seventh, at the bottom, Malchut, which is translated, Malchut literally means royalty and sovereignty. Melech is a king. Malka is the queen. Malchut is the feminine. Malchut is royalty. Feminine royalty, the queen, if you will, leadership, but it also means, for our purposes today, receptivity. And we're going to discuss in a moment the apparent paradox or the contradiction between receptivity and leadership. I'm going to address that in a moment. But first, let's explain all of this. The way I want to do this is by looking at the days of the week. I think it's highly significant that in the United States of America, and in any known cult, any society that I'm aware of, there are 7 days to a week. Have you ever wondered why there are 7 days to a week? It's fascinating, right? A day, I understand. 24-hour segment makes sense. If you're looking at the heavens, and you're trying to calculate time based on cycles, 24 hours makes a ton of sense. Because every 24 hours... the sun returns, or the position where you are with the sun in the sky, etc., it's going to be a similar construct, right? 24 hours, there's a cycle there. A month, I also understand. 29 and a half days, I get why there's a month. That's the lunar cycle. I get why there's a year. The day again is sunrise, sunset. That's the basic, you know, the basic movement of time. The lunar cycle is 29 and a half days, the lunar cycle. So that I get why there's months. I get why there's a year. 360, I get that. 365 days, everything returns, earth and sun, back to how it was positioned a year before. I get that. All of that I get.
Who was it? Ben Ishchai got it for 6,000 years, right? Is it Ben Ishchai?
As far as the calendar?
Yeah.
The Jewish calendars have been worked out till
6,000.
Yeah, till whenever. But here's my question. All of that I get, but what's with the week? The week makes no sense. What happens every 7 days? On an astronomical level, what happens every 7 days? What happens? Nothing.
Shabbat.
Well, hold on. Besides for this Jewish stuff, besides for the spiritual stuff, what happens every 7 days?
Nothing.
Nothing. Nothing happens. Nothing happens in 7 days. So why is this? Why is there this segment of time? Why has time been segmented into groups of weeks? Makes no sense. I'll tell you why, and it's. Use this in bar trivia discussions at your own discretion. But the reason is because on an energy level, on a spiritual energy level, the fabric of creation is divided into seven energies. That's the way it is. And on the eighth day, in other words, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And number 8 parallels energy number 1. It has to start over again. That's the way it is. There's Yom Rishon, Yom Sheni, Yom Shishi. Day 1, day 2, day 3, day 4, day 5, day 6. Corresponding to Chesed, Gevura, Teferet, Netzach, Hod, and Yesod. And then you have Shabbat. Shabbat is called... Wait a second. What do we say Shabbat is called? Shabbat is called in the Lecha Dodi, the Queen. And it's also called the Bride. Right? It's called the queen, it's called the bride, it's called the queen though, right? It's called Malchut. The seventh energy is the queen, is Shabbat, is femininity, etc. And after that, you run out of energies and you recite, you go back to Chesed Sunday. Sunday is Chesed, Monday is Gevura. You know what Gevura means? Gevura means also strength, but it also means kind of withdrawing. That's why people are depressed on Mondays, and it's not only going back to work. On an energy level, I'm actually not joking. I am joking, but I'm not joking. I'm saying it hopefully in a humorous way, but it's true. Sundays are associated with Chesed, love, joy, exuberance. Gevura is like this. Chesed is like this. Let's go out after Kabbalah and coffee. Let's go and hike, and let's go and see the world. Let's go out to the Beltline, whatever it is. Gevura is like this. It's the energy of Gevura. Teferet is its own energy. Whatever. Each of the days of the week. And again, it's not a challenge, but I put it out there. I need someone to explain to me another good reason why societies have segmented the weeks into 7 days. Forget why a week into 7 days. Why a week to begin with? If not for the fact that the Torah says that the world is created in 7 days. And again, on a mystical level... Because you could still ask the question, even after you have the Torah telling us that the world was created in 7 days, who cares? And even if you, let me explain, even if you run with that origin, universe origin theory whatever, even if you run with the Torah's account of creation, so why do I need to have a 7 day week? I'm not creating the world again, right? Why do I need to live with that? So that happened then, so who cares? Let me mark time with days and months and years. Like, what do I need the weeks for? The Kabbalists explain, because it's ongoing. God infused day one with an energy, and on day one, the same energy is being infused into the world. Chesed, the Kabbalists say that in the Torah, it's a grammatical thing. It doesn't say that God created the world in 6 days. It says God created the world with 6 days. What does it mean with 6 days? With the six energy days of Chesed through Yesod. God created the world utilizing these Sefirot. So each day has an energy. And when the next week comes around, it once again cycles back through those energies. And therefore it's significant that we have weeks and significant that we count 7 days and cycle it back. But here's my point. All of this is true and all of this might be wonderful, but here's my point for mentioning this. There's a fundamental distinction in Jewish life between the 6 days of the week and the seventh. What's the difference? What do we associate the 6 days of the week with?
Work.
Work. And the seventh with?
Rest.
Rest. Masculine and feminine. Mashpia, mekabel. Giving and receiving. Think about the distinction. Masculine, and again, this is not men and women right now. This is masculine and feminine energies that both men and women possess. Masculine energy is conquering energy. It's changing energy. It's, I don't like the way this looks. Let's change it. Let's build something. Let's create something. All of the aspects, all of the elements of forbidden labor on Shabbat represent that which we're supposed to do on the other 6 days. And they're all creative types of labor. It's not about schlepping a heavy table from one side of your house to the other. That's fine. It's all about creating something new. Creating something, i.e. changing something within the fabric of creation. Right, so building something. Changing something, not the location of something, but changing something fundamentally is considered to be labor. It's considered to be work. Why? 6 days a week, we change the world. We say the world's not good enough. Things don't look good. We need to change it. It's a very masculine approach. Like, let's break it. Let's make it. Let's change it. It's no good. Whereas the feminine energy of Malchut, which is receptivity, is basically the energy of saying, let's work with what we have. Let's seek to discover the beauty in what is and not try to superimpose something else upon what is. One way of looking at the world is saying, it's flawed, it's broken, or it's not good enough. Let's change something about it. There's another way to say, let's cultivate what exists and bring out its inner beauty. Say it again. The week represents a union. You have the 6 days and Shabbat, and you need that. You need both energies to have a week. But what we see here is that Malchut, which is Shabbat, Shabbat's a feminine energy. On Shabbat, we don't work. In other words, we don't create. What we say is, what we declare through our absence of work is, we declare that God's world is beautiful, just the way it is. 6 days a week, we say it's not beautiful enough. We need to change it. We need to modify it. We need to hack it, right? We need to spruce it up. On Shabbat, we say, let's enjoy what we got. Let's cultivate the inner beauty. It's like gardening, and I'm not a gardener, but it's like gardening from what I understand. So there's two ways to look at gardening. One is that you say, let's bring in new stuff, let's plant new stuff. That's part of gardening. 6 days a week we plant new stuff. Planting, by the way, is also one of the Shabbat things that we say not to do because that's a 6 day a week job. So 6 days a week we plant. On Shabbat, we cultivate what's already there. And we bring out the beauty of the garden that exists. So 6 days a week, we say it's not good enough. Let's put something new in. On Shabbat, we say, it's beautiful the way it is. Masculine, feminine. Change, or kind of external change, if you will. External, you know, putting something else in, adding something on, changing something. As opposed to cultivating the beauty from within. Now, you need both in life. You need both. You need the masculine, you need the feminine. And perhaps the majority of the time is indeed the 6 day of the week modality. You need that, if you will, that masculine energy to add more, to change things, etc. But one day a week, and in Jewish life, of course, the focal point of the week is Shabbat. So one day a week, and it's not just one out of seven, which sounds like the minority, but it's on an energy level, it's in quality, the greatest day of the week, the apex, everything leads up to Shabbat. And what is the energy of Shabbat? That is the feminine energy of receptivity. It's only through this co-joining, this union of the 6 days of the week and Shabbat, that you have the totality of what it means to live a healthy, productive life from a Jewish understanding. You have both the work and the... You have both the change and the acceptance, if you will. In other words, it's almost like in life where you have this push for the sense of things are broken, let's change it, and a sense of acceptance, this is the way it is, let's enjoy what we have. I know I said that before, but I'm just thinking about this maybe in different terms. You know, there's facing a reality in your life that you don't like, and there's trying to change it, trying to break it, trying to knock it down, and then there's, let's discover the potential here in this moment. Let me accept the reality. I can't change the reality. Right? Maybe the narrative is the narrative. Maybe the circumstance is the circumstance. Let me try to uncover the beauty within it and cultivate the opportunity here that is. So one modality is, I don't like the circumstance, I'm going to change it. That's like a masculine approach. That's like, I don't like it, let's break it, knock it down, and rebuild it. The other approach is, I get the parameters that I'm working within. How do I cultivate the best out of this moment? How do I make the best of this situation? I'll tear it down and rebuild it, right. Good, right. Right, I'll hire someone to do it. Right. So again, all of that is still somewhat of a masculine approach. The feminine approach is, and again, it's not men, women, it's not male, female, it's just masculine versus feminine on an energy level. So it's the feminine approach is let's work, it's kind of like acceptance. It's not kind of like, it is in a sense acceptance. And if you think that this is passive, then I'd like to encourage you to really, you know, there's a phrase called active listening. Listening is an active art. It's not passive. Listening requires a lot of activity on the part of the listener. In other words, to truly receive, to truly accept, to truly embrace, to truly cultivate from within, there's a lot of work that happens, but it's a different type of work than the outside I'm going to change. It's work on the inside as opposed to work on the outside. Think about this. Let's now talk biologically. In the creation of a child, the male is doing outside work, and the mother is inside work. And you might say that, well, the outside work can be seen. The inside work, I mean, I'm not, other than now we have the sonograms and everything now, like the last many years, right now, suddenly, we have the sonogram, so we can see kind of what's on the inside. But up until then, right, no one knows. You can't see, right? No one knows what's going on the inside. Where does the real magic happen, obviously? In the male or with the male or with the female in childbirth, obviously, where does the magic happen? Where does the development happen? Cultivation, etc.? Production of life itself? Inside the mother. So the feminine energy, although we can say that on the one hand it's receptivity, on the other hand, let's not diminish what receptivity is. Let's not say, oh, receptivity sounds like passive, not active, it's like secondary role, whatever. Really? Passive? Secondary? Are you kidding me? Have you ever seen life being created? There's nothing passive and there's nothing secondary. It's primary and it's very much active. But it's operating in a different way. It's operating in a very, very different way. There's creation from the outside or changing something out externally, and then there's cultivating from the inside. Two different worlds, two different realities. And they're both needed. You need the contribution of the male, and you need the cultivation, the active cultivation production of the female to create life. That's the way it is. We've explained this before when it comes to Malchut. Malchut here is not here. Malchut is literally translated as royalty, sovereignty, in the context of, we don't have kings anymore, so at least in the United States we don't have kings. Well, whatever, we don't have a monarchy. So leadership is probably the best word that we can use to kind of convey that which exists at the top. In the Jewish understanding of leadership, it's not the one who has the loudest opinion, because that's a masculine energy. A true leader is someone who takes in, who is a good listener, who receives all of the input, has their own ideas certainly, but takes in all the input, and then develops a strategy based on everything that's put into it. Everything that was put in. Like a healthy meeting, there has to be a leader at a meeting, right? But a healthy meeting is where there's input gathered and utilizing the best ideas from all the ideas, let's create something magical. It's input. I mean, companies have figured this out. I mentioned this, I don't know, maybe last week or a few weeks ago, that, or maybe not even in this class, in another context, but companies have, or maybe not at all, in my own head, doesn't matter. Companies have figured out that the greatest ideas are born of healthy collaboration. Did we discuss this about how meetings were set up in the past? Okay. I think the person
at the beginning of this lesson here.
But I didn't mention specifically, I think it's Pixar, Disney, I think it was the animation, the Disney animation, the Pixar. So they don't just make, you know, animated films. What did Pixar make? Like Toy Story and all of these things. So it's not, their goal is not just to make something that kids like, but something that has depth to it, something that tells a story. Because otherwise it's just, you know, it's just cartoons, you know, whatever, randomness. So there's a story, there's a narrative, there's life lessons, you know, it's emotional. You can read the story on multiple levels. It appeals to children and it could appeal to adults, right? There's many lessons of childhood and loss and love and big themes, right? Big themes like Finding Nemo. It's like parents, children, and loss, and growth, and, you know, letting go of, right? All of this stuff, like big themes. You have to storyboard. There's a lot of chachma, a lot of wisdom that goes into creating these types of things. They found that the old modality of meetings is where they had like the heads of the team sitting kind of in the middle. And then, as it fanned out, you had like the youngest tenured people and those that were there, but, you know, and they typically didn't speak up because the conversation happened in the middle and not in the fringes. But I'm sure I mentioned this at some point recently. And there was one time where the conference room was not available. Maybe they were doing construction something happened and it wasn't available. So they went to another room, and because it was a different room, so the hierarchy of where people sat didn't apply. Everyone just kind of sat down where they sat down. And they had a meeting. They had a staff meeting, a collaborative meeting of ideas and whatever. But it wasn't like all of the heads were sitting together in the middle and everyone else in the fringes. It was kind of, you had a fringe person in the middle and you had a head person on the side. You had a mix. Everyone was mixed. And the discussion and the collaboration was on another level. And the creativity and the ideas that were produced from that meeting went on a different level. And they realized that they were lacking, as creative as they were lacking true collaboration. And you cannot have true creativity without the collaboration. You cannot produce a creative idea, as I mentioned before at the beginning of the class, in an echo chamber. Because all you're having is the same idea regurgitated. It's not creativity. Creativity is born of opposites, of different ideas, of bouncing things back and forth. And creativity truly happens in the realm of Malchut. Don't worry, it's an automatic shut-off. It goes off after an hour. So Malchut is the hub, if you will, that takes in all the ideas and then produces something fabulous based on all of the ideas and based on cultivating the best of that idea. I just want to mention it this way. Rebecca, can you close that door for a second? Thank you. If you've ever had, think of it this way. How do you feel if you're working for somebody and there's a meeting and you share your idea and your idea is discounted As opposed to if you're in a meeting and you share your idea and the response is, that's a great idea, let's see how we can implement it. Which is more empowering? The latter, obviously. We all want to hear that our ideas are taken into consideration and are being put into the final product, right? It's a great thing. Now, not every idea, not every element of every idea, but the general modality is one of cultivation and acceptance and receiving and listening, as opposed to, no, this is what we're going to do, and blah, blah, right, all that stuff. So the whole dictatorship and that whole, it's like an old model. It's a masculine model. And it's not the Kabbalistic model of success. The Kabbalistic model of success is you have the six inputs of masculinity, and then you have the feminine receptivity of Malchut, the active receptivity of Malchut, and Malchut is what then produces and births the next dimension of reality. So again, reality is scaffolded. Right, reality is scaffolded, which means it's built out on multiple dimensions. So you have this is, for example, in the world of Atzilut, the world of emanation. But then below it, you have the world of Bria, the world of creation. And how is creation produced from emanation? How is Bria produced from Atzilut? It's from Malchut. The lowest point of this reality produces the highest point of the subsequent reality. In other words, Malchut, like the feminine energy, like the female below, Malchut literally births into being, into existence, the next dimension below it. But Malchut can't do it alone. The feminine energy can't do it alone. Just as the six points of masculine energy, i.e. Zah, can't produce reality on its own, so too Malchut can't do it on its own. You need this co-joining, you need this union, this supernal union of masculine and feminine energies to produce a new reality. And so here's what the Kabbalists say. We know how bodies are created, right? That's a biology class will tell you how bodies are created, right? Male contribution, female contribution, residing 9 months, developing 9 months in the mother, in the female, and then a child is born. That's how bodies are produced. But have you ever thought about how souls are produced? When are souls produced? Not when does life begin? When does the soul enter the body? That is a question. But the question is, when is a soul born? At the conception of the parents? No, that's when the soul enters the body. But when is the spirit born? At the beginning of creation? When the parents conceive a child, then, oh, quickly, let's make a new soul? Like, how does that work?
They're already here, aren't they?
They're actually
not. Souls are birthed in the same process as bodies are birthed. In other words, just like a human body, physical body, is produced by a union of masculine and feminine energies, so too a soul is likewise produced of the same union, not the same, but likewise produced of a union of masculine and feminine. And what is it? Zah and Malchus, this union. The union of Sochesed, Gvurah, Tiferet, Netzach, Hod, Yesod. Those six masculine energies. Joining together with Malchut, that produces a spiritual birth of a soul and other spiritual dimensions as well. But that also produces a soul. So just like the body is a product of masculine and feminine, of male and female, of Zachar and Nekeva, Dechar and Nukva, so too a soul on a spiritual level is likewise produced of the very of a similar type of union between masculine and feminine. Obviously, it's not occurring in a physical way because we're not talking about physical things. We're talking about spiritual things. So the union happens on a spiritual level, on a cosmic level. But without the union, you don't have a soul. You cannot have the birth of a soul without the union of these divine energies.
If you want to call it born.
Yeah, already in existence somewhere.
Existence. So my question is,
is this still happening? Is this union still happening? Is it an ongoing thing or did it happen?
Are they dividing and becoming more?
Right. Great question.
The soul is whatever.
Reincarnated. There's a great question. Most souls today, most of us, are recycled souls. Reincarnated souls, which
parts
means
of one,
parts of
the
souls
other,
that have already that have already been, the souls have already been created and even have been down here before. But you do have, once in a while, a neshama chadash, a new soul that is birthed. It's a rare occasion. As time stretches on, the Kabbalists say it happens more infrequently. But you have, there are some tzaddikim that are considered to be a neshama chadash, a new soul. They say about the Alter Rebbe, the founder of Chabad, that he was a neshama chadash, a new soul. It takes those that can see what a soul is, right, to be able to identify the origins. But this is how, even if the souls already exist, how did they come into existence originally? It happened only through this union, yeah.
But I'm confused why a new soul would be at the level of tzaddikim.
What it means is, it's pure, it's like, in a sense, it's pure and fresh from the source. In other words, it's a pure reproduction from the source. It's like fresh out. It hasn't been diluted, it hasn't been tainted, it hasn't been, you know, sullied by journeys back and forth, whatever. It's a pure it's like a fresh dog. It's a lahavdil, don't take this in any literal way, but it's like a fresh dollar from the mint, or fresh coin from the mint. It's like there's a certain clarity, there's a certain freshness that you have. Okay, so all of this is to explain that the masculine and feminine energies not only exist down here, and not only on a physical human plane are key to creation of new life, etc., but these energies exist on a spiritual cosmic plane. They exist in the highest dimensions of the universe itself. They don't constitute God. God is way beyond any specific definitions and energies. But God, as God wishes to create or chooses to create, God creates using this formula, again, masculine and feminine, and in the language of the mystics, and in the, not only the language, but in the construct of Kabbalah, you have these parallels within time also. You have 6 and 1. 6 days of the week, we work, we produce. It's an external work of fuel, changing things. 7th day, we accept, we receive. And it's, by the way, only the way we understand this Kabbalistically, as we'll see soon in this text, as we read it inside, it's only through the union of the 6 days and Shabbat, it's only through this union that the next week can be birthed. How do you have a new week born? It's only when you have 6 days and 1 day, masculine and feminine, now you have the birth, the emergence of a healthy new week.
This is the outline for the Sefirat HaOmer.
That's also, yes, the same, yeah. The Sefirat HaOmer that we're, the counting of the Omer that we're in the middle of. We just started last night. We just started week number 4, which is Netzach. So it's 7 weeks between Passover and Shavuot. First week is the week of Chesed. Second week is Gvura, Teferet, Netzach, Hod, Yesod. Malchut is the last week. By the way, what happened at Sinai? What did we do at Sinai? 7 weeks after the Exodus, what do we do at Sinai? We received the Torah. Received the Torah. The feminine, the energy of receiving, we receive. God gave. We received. So the 7th week, the last one is Malchut. We build up to that receptivity.
Well, this could be applied to, I mean, there's so many things now that we could apply this to. So many things in time are in sevens. Even giving of the releasing of the loans in every 7 years.
The releasing of the loans and the sabbatical year of letting the crops.
Yeah, and then on the 49th year, the 50th.
7 times 7. Right. You have that cycle that goes 7 times 7. 100%. That's exactly Kabbalistically why every 7 years in ancient Israel they used to let the crops go ownerless. It's not my field. I don't own it. I don't plant it. I don't till it. I don't sow it. I don't plow it. I don't do anything. The land just grows on its own. It's the 7th year. It's this receptivity. It's embracing
something
what is.
In our lifetime, we just had something just happened just a few years ago. That was the 49th year.
The 50th. It was the Jubilee year. Yeah, it was the Yovel. Yeah. Now let's read all of this inside. So 22 at the bottom. Does everybody have a copy? Are there extra copies that I feel like we got? Maybe I didn't have enough copies today. Okay, so yeah, if you guys can share a little bit, because I think we're short some copies. Okay, so this is the text. It's called The Majestic Bride. We are bottom of page 22 where it says supernal queen. Here we go. Everybody with me? Where it says in the brackets to explain the concept of queen? Yes? Yes, yes, yes? Yes? Okay. Let's start. To explain the concept of queen, what is queen? What is this feminine energy of queen that Shabbat is likened to? So, it is written in Genesis, let us make man in our image after our likeness. It says regarding the creation of the human being, so God says, let us, first of all, there's plurality there, so who's the plural, right? Let us make man in our image after our likeness. So the fundamental question on this verse is, well, first of all, who's the us with God? Does God have a committee? Number two, what does it mean that the human being is created in the image of God? Does God have an image? God is beyond definition. So that means God is imageless. If God has an image, we're in trouble. That means we have a human God. Like, that's not, we don't want, if God has an image, we need a new God. There's got to be something beyond that, because image can't be at the top. There has to be beyond image. So what does it mean that we're creating the image of God? Since when does God have an image? The answer, you know, I already gave you the answer. The answer is, we're not talking about the essence of God, but as God chooses to create, God projects himself or part of himself through the Ten Sefirot, assuming that image. It's almost like a prism, a crystal prism, where the light shines through, and then the crystal, the prism, refracts the light and shows the different colors that are embedded in the light. So too, these Ten Sefirot, in a sense, refract God's pure oneness into various different dimensions. So here we go, and here we have it inside. This means, the text says, that physical man is created in the image and likeness of supernal man, Adam Ha'elyon, supernal man, which refers to the supernal Sefirot. So this is, again, not God's essence, which is beyond any sort of image and likeness, obviously. This is only referring to God as God projects himself through and with the Sefirot on a level where God is actually referred to as Adam Ha'elyon, supernal man. Now, God is not supernal man. God is not a man. Not a low man, not a high man. But again, this is as God projects himself through the Sefirot, we call this reality Adam Ha'elyon, higher supernal man, i.e. the 10th Sefirot. This is even likened to, if you will, a human body, which is also balanced between right, left, and center. Right? There's arms. It says in Kabbalah, right arm, left arm, middle. This is left, right leg, left leg, etc. So you have these different, the human body is structured in a right, left, center reality. I mean, just look at the eyes and the nose, right? Right, one on the right, one on the left, one in the center. So that's why we say this stems from the way it is above, and that's why it's depicted in this way. This is called the partsuf, which literally means face. This is the face of the Sefirot that he has. It's structured in this type of setting. The point is that human beings are created in the image of the divine, i.e. in the divine Sefirot image. Page 24. Now, within the supernal Sefirot, and again, you're going to find here what we've just discussed over the last hour and 15 minutes or so. Within the supernal Sefirot, Ze'er Anpin, and you know what that means now, right? The small face of Atzilut is called king, masculine, right? So what this Zah, the six Sefirot, the six energies of Chesed, Gvur, Tfer, Netzach, Hod, and Yisod, the red, the top six red Sefirot in this depiction, that is called Ze'er Anpin, and it's called king, masculine. Indeed, let's in the set off text with the M dashes. Indeed, the statement that, quote, the image of every soul stood before the holy king is explained to be referring to Ze'er Anpin of Atzilut. Every soul stands before, what does it mean stands before? Every soul originates from Zah. From Zah, every soul stood before a supernal king. What does it mean? That every soul stands before God? Like a subject before a king? Like they're physically standing before a physical king? No, that's not what it means. That's concretizing mystical teachings. What it means is that every soul originates, stems from the holy king, i.e. from the masculine energy of Zah. In other words, like you would say, a child emanates from the father. What is the first origins of a child? First, there's, I mean, I guess in timeline, the timeline is timeline, right? In a traditional way of producing a child, first you have the male contribution, which is then received by by the female, and then the child is, and then everything else develops from there. But the first thing is you have the contribution from the male. So the point is that the origins, the first origins of a soul, are before, quote, the holy king, i.e., the masculine energies of Zoh. Now let's continue. Zerampin, the sixth sphirot. And this, let's continue. And the sphere of Malchut is called queen. So, again, king and queen. Six dimensions of the king, one dimension of the queen. And this is the key. This is the key to address what you mentioned before. Now, the Zohar states, Zohar is one of the fundamental works of Kabbalah. The Holy Zohar states that a king without a queen is neither a king nor great. A king without a queen is not a king. You can't have a king without a queen. How are you a king without a queen? How can you be a mashpia if you don't have a makabel? How can you be a giver without a receiver? You with me? You're not a giver if you don't have a receiver. You can't have masculine energy. Go produce a child with just the male contribution. Good luck. You can't have a king without a queen. Lav ihu melech v'lav ihu gadol. He's not a king and he's not great. There's no inherent, the point is. Whereas the world says, for the last 5,778 years, the world has always believed that we live in a masculine, male-dominated society. Right? That the male, that the masculine energy and males, physically males, etc., are the dominant gender. And that things should revolve around the masculine, right? And the whole notion of feminine power is like a—it's like a novel, it's like a chiddush, like a new thing, it's like a novel thing. Kabbalah says, the Zohar says, 2,000 years ago, that Melech below Malka, king without a queen, Lavi hu Melech v'Lavi hu Gadol. He's not a king; he's not great. In other words, wherein lies the true greatness? It's within the sphere of Malchut. It's within this female energy receptivity. If you take a seed and you put it in a metal bowl, nothing is going to grow. Nothing is going to grow. You'll have a seed in a bowl, mazel tov. You put a seed in a pouch, you have a seed in a pouch. And I mean like a foil, rip up. And you have that at the store. You go to Ace Hardware, you go to a store, any store, and you have seeds. And they didn't grow in the store. Why? Because they weren't planted in something that received it. It didn't, the mashpia, the giver, so to speak, never hit that which received it, which accepted it, embraced it, and covered it, and developed it. Never happened. So the seed never grew. It only grows when you have a makaba, when you have a recipient, when you have, which is the earth. When you have the earth, and it happens to be that we take the earth for granted. You know what we do with the earth? We step on it. You step on it. You know how holy the earth is? You step on the earth. I'm not saying the earth is God. I'm not saying holy on that level. But it's the divine power of growth is in the earth. We're stepping on the earth. I know what you're going to ask. So where should we walk? Fine. But at least it should bother us. The earth is what produces everything. At least have a little bit of humility to recognize what the earth is. The earth is something to tread on. The earth is something to just, to destroy or whatever. The earth is where the power of creativity lies. Production, growth, the most amazing things happen in the earth. We could not survive without the earth. All right, fine, we created hydroponic stuff, fine. I don't know how that works. But growth, life itself is in the earth. That which appears to be beneath. Malchut appears to be the lowest. And it's the highest. The feminine, for too long, feminine energy has been seen to be the weaker, the less, the lower than, etc. And that's not true. It's the biggest lie that's ever been perpetrated. And Kabbalah sets the record straight. So, if we think that Judaism, especially Kabbalah, is a male-dominated society, all you need to do is study a little bit of Kabbalah, and you'll soon recognize how Malchut is the greatest. Shabbat, of all the days of the week, we don't celebrate Sunday, we don't celebrate Monday, we don't celebrate Tuesday, and not Wednesday, and not Thursday, and not Friday. The one day a week that we celebrate as a holiday each and every week is the feminine day of the week, a Shabbat. It's the feminine energy that stands above everything. But because it's not, because the feminine energy is by its nature, the nature of femininity, not, I'm not saying men or women, but the nature of the feminine energy is not loud and outside bombastic, because it's more of a cultivating, nurturing from the inside, therefore, it can be overlooked. Because it's quiet, because it's inner versus outer. You know, the people at the meeting that make the most noise, those are the ones that are maybe, they make the most noise. But it's not always the ones with the most wisdom are the ones that are speaking the loudest. There's not always a correlation between the two. So the point of this is that it requires both. That birth, and this is the point of today, birth is the product of a union of opposites. There's no birth below and no birth above that can happen without a union. It's not only the female. It's not only the feminine. It's a union. But within the union, which is primary? Within the union, which is the key? And the answer Kabbalistically, and I think biologically, is it's the feminine. It's the female. That energy, the Malchut energy, the queen energy, the bride energy. Remember, this is said at a wedding. The previous Rebbe was marrying off his daughter. The Rebbe got married to the previous Rebbe's daughter. He's saying this at her wedding, his daughter's wedding, extolling the virtue of the bride. The right before Kabbalah Panim, receiving, welcoming the bride. And the point of all of this is that although it takes two energies, opposite forces to produce something new, the primary element is Malchut. The primary element is receptivity. 26. Likewise, we're going to finish off in just a minute. Likewise, in the Torah's account of the creation of man and woman, it is only after male and female He created them that God blessed them. It says only after, and maybe I think what we'll do is I'll pick this up in more depth next week. We'll start off with this point. But I just want to read a little bit just to kind of set the stage for next week. Plant some seeds for next week. Hopefully you're receiving the seeds that I'm planting, right? So we have this union, if you will. Huh? Right. So it says in the Torah, multiple different versions, if you will, of the creation of human beings. But one thing is clear, the first time we find that God blesses the human being is not Adam alone. It's only after Zachar and Nekeva Barosim, it's only after male and female that there's a blessing. Let's continue very quickly. So the female aspect, Malchut, is the source of this blessing. In other words, the blessing is only born when you have the female. The blessing only happens when you have Chava, Eve. And the same is true of Shabbat and Bride, who are likened to Malchut Queen. They too are the sources of supernal blessings. It's not just secondary. It's not secondary. It's not lesser than. It's not weaker. It's not passive. God forbid. It's active and it's primary and it's the source of blessings. Therefore, and let's conclude this section, just as Shabbat must be received with joy, as Shabbat is the source of all supernal terrestrial blessings, and all the days of the subsequent week are blessed from Shabbat. As I mentioned before, your next week is born from Shabbat. Oh, similarly, must the bride be received with joy as she is the source of the lofty blessings. We're going to pick it up next week. So, if you think that the angle on this is going to be men, women, masculine, and feminine, and the virtues of the masculine, so you're in for a surprise, but the cat's already out of the bag. The point of all of this is to extol the virtues of Malchut, of the feminine energy, of the bride, of the queen, etc. So what we did today to summarize is we started developing two points: the masculine-feminine duality in Kabbalah, as well as the concept of giving and receiving. And what we explained is that you need both elements, masculine and feminine, to produce something new. All birth is the product of the joining of masculine and feminine, and that interplay happens in a unique way, because the masculine energy is more the giving, the feminine energy more the receiving, but the receiving is active, And active receiving is what really is at the core of the magic of creation. Thank you very much for joining me today for Kabbalah and Coffee.